Hello, and welcome to Empowering Minds, Mental Health Europe's podcast featuring conversations with mental health experts, psychologists and psychiatrists, practitioners and people with lived experience. I'm Margie, Junior Communication Officer at Mental Health Europe, and today we will talk about the psychosocial model of mental health. In a society constantly focused on the demands of fast-paced environments and productivity, the importance of taking care of one's mental health and mental well-being cannot be overstated. For decades, Mental Health Europe has researched the impact of societal norms, institutional practices, and legislation on people's mental health and mental health rights. Most importantly, Mental Health Europe advocates for a shift from a biomedical to a psychosocial approach to mental health. What does this mean? What is the psychosocial model and how can it help fighting mental health stigma? This podcast episode aims at answering to these questions and more with the help of two experts, Bob Grove and Fatima Awil. Bob is the honorary advisor to Mental Health Europe, of which he has been a member since it was founded. His particular area of interest and research is mental health and employment. He has been the CEO of the Center for Mental Health, formerly known as the Sainsbury's Center, and he has also worked on deinstitutionalization programs in Greece and other parts of Europe. Fatima is Mental Health Europe's Policy and Knowledge Officer. She has a background in human rights research, policy, and advocacy with NGOs. Fatima is an intersectional feminist, as well as an experienced speaker and advocate, with over 9 years of experience in advocacy and campaigning. How would you describe the psychosocial model of mental health as opposed to the biomedical one?
Well, for a start, I prefer to call it a psychosocial approach because it's not really a single model. It's more a way of thinking about mental health and mental health problems, which focuses on people's lives rather than on what is wrong with their brains. When we say people have unwanted thoughts and emotions, then there is an assumption that something may be wrong with them, that this is not in some way normal. But in the way of thinking that we would call the psychosocial approach, we actually regard mental distress and these kind of unwanted thoughts and feelings as quite normal and natural responses to life events, relationships that have ended. The question is not really what is wrong with this person, because there's nothing wrong with them in this. They are human beings. They have had things happen to them, and it's the things that happen to them and what the things that happen to them mean that the psychosocial approach is really focused on. The social bit implies that we're social animals. We're the products of the times and cultures in which we live. The meanings that we ascribe to our lives and our lives' events are shaped by the culture in which we live. And we know that when communities that we live in are under stress through poverty or violence or substantial inequality, then rates of mental ill health are much higher. This approach that I'm describing is not new. People have had this insight over many centuries. For example, at the beginning of the 19th century, William Tuke, who was an English Quaker and philanthropist who lived in York in England, founded a new type of what he called an asylum, which has come to obviously mean different things to us, but a different sort of asylum in which what he regarded as barbaric treatments for mental ill health, such as bloodletting and manacles and isolation, were abandoned in favor of humane practices such as warm baths, proper diet and exercise, meaningful work and benevolent social interactions. This model was really hugely influential throughout the 19th century, but we've really lost it in many ways There is a legacy, however, still with us in the therapeutic community movement. On a slightly different tack, in the early part of the 20th century, Freud had the insight that the problems his patients brought to him were related to distressing traumatic relationships in early life with parental figures. Now, there's been a certain amount of criticism of some of the details of Freud's theory and practice, because after all, he did live in a very particular place in a very particular time. But this fundamental insight, early experiences condition the way we are, and that there is a therapeutic value in talking about and understanding these feelings and experiences, has remained the cornerstone of many of today's therapies. However, and this is where we get to the biomedical model, in the last 50, 60 years has seen the increasing dominance of the biomedical model, or disease model, what is termed mental illness. This way of thinking thinks about mental illness as essentially the same class as problem as a physical illness, such as cancer or heart disease. The disease, according to the people who promote this, is located in the brains of those suffering from what is in fact an ever-increasing list of medical diagnoses, and is described to the general public as in terms of faulty wiring or chemical imbalance in the brain. The Bible of the biomedical model is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, published by the American Psychiatric Association. The problem with this model is the complete absence of any scientific evidence to support the idea that the brains of people experiencing mental ill health are defective or abnormal. Despite decades of research, no one has ever found biological markers associated with psychiatric diagnoses. The diagnoses in the DSM are not based on biology, but on observed or self-reported thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, which are then classified and named by committees of psychiatrists. The reasons for the dominance of this model are mainly financial. Drugs for long-term or supposedly incurable illnesses are very profitable, turning pharmaceutical corporations into some of the most wealthy firms in the world. Psychiatric drugs do bring short-term relief for some people, but for many, this is a terrible price, which may include emotional flatness or numbness, problems with sexual activity and dependency, which means that people must stay on them for life, or risk a painful process of withdrawal in which the original so-called symptoms recur with greater volume and rapidity. This makes them the perfect vehicle for making money. And indeed, they are some of the most profitable drugs in the world.
Why do you think right now there is a shift happening from the biomedical to the psychosocial?
I mean, I think it started becoming very dominant. And I think I'd like to just go back a little bit with that. It started becoming very dominant and affecting large swathes of the population when pills such as Valium and sleeping pills started to be used to take the edge off the dissatisfaction with post-war life. That many women forced to stay at home and out of the workforce experienced in the 1950s. What was not recognized for a long time was the ways in which these mother's little helpers created long-term negative side effects and dependency. The same applies really to the major tranquilizers that we used in hospitals. The evidence that the failure of this model is very overwhelming. Mental ill health is increasing exponentially, reaching epidemic proportions in some Western countries. Stories told about drugs which deal with chemical imbalances in the brain have crumbled and been shown to be without any scientific basis whatsoever. Most recently, Dr. Joanna Moncrief published a paper demonstrating the falsity of the serotonin theory of depression and posing the question of why it has, given that it has been long since discarded by scientists, it's still used by drug companies and their publicists. The prescriptions for psychiatric drugs are increasing. About one-fifth of the adult population of England takes antidepressants of one kind or another. And these are drugs which in randomized controlled trials have been shown to be little better than placebos, with beneficial effects so small that they're clinically insignificant. The reason, therefore, that people have started to question this model is because it doesn't work, and because people, particularly people who have experienced the psychiatric services themselves, are beginning to be very disenchanted about it and beginning to ask very important questions about the effects of the treatments which they're being given. Alongside this has become a movement towards much more towards recovering by means of actually looking at the whole person. Starting from this point, there are many different psychosocial approaches to the journey to recovery. No one size fits all, either for individuals or communities. What works for one person may not work for another. What works in one place or culture may be entirely inappropriate for another. What the approaches have in common is an exploratory and supportive dialogue of equals, working towards an understanding of what has gone wrong and the sharing of solutions. This can be between individuals or within groups or in the wider community, all working towards the same goals.
So in your opinion, why is it crucial to transition then from a biomedical-centric view to a more comprehensive approach to understanding mental health?
Because the biomedical model has failed and is failing. Because mental ill health is increasing, you would expect that if, as with any other disease, if it really is the same as any other disease, then you would expect with all these new treatments that people would become less mentally ill or people would be cured or recovered. They don't. More people are becoming more mentally ill. People are becoming mentally ill for longer. And many people are now feeling that the treatments are actually prolonging and making worse the original problem rather than helping them. In other words, the treatments are getting in the way of people's recovery. There's no question that there is a role for psychiatric drugs. They do provide relief for some people for very, very acute forms of distress and behavior and feeling. But these effects are necessary but short-lived. The problem is that the other effect of these drugs is that people remain on them for longer, and all the other disadvantages then therefore start to come in. And the main one being dependency, the terrible, terrible difficulty of getting off psychiatric drugs that people experience. Because as soon as they stop taking them, if they stop taking them too abruptly or without any kind of help from people who know what they're doing, then the original distress comes back, but much more floridly, much more painfully. And therefore, the answer is to go back on the drugs and with all the restrictions to life that they produce.
Statistics from 2016, which is a bit dated, tells us that around 84 million Europeans have experienced mental health problems at some point in their lives, or one in four of us will experience mental health problems in our lifetime. And we've seen an understanding around mental health being connected to our environments, especially during COVID. We've seen how being isolated, being disconnected from our social circles, from our, you know, normal daily lives, from disruption in education, we've seen that there's a connection between our mental health and our social determinants, our environment. And the psychosocial model considers the links between mental health and mental health problems and social exclusion and socioeconomic determinants of mental health. And what we need to do now is ensure that we apply the correct approach to addressing mental health.
You mentioned these psychosocial determinants of mental health, but can you explain a bit more in details what these are and how they influence a person's well-being?
When it comes to mental health, we have to look at two different things. So the first is protective factors, which are things that contribute to our mental health and allow for a person to be able to cope with life's challenges. So, for example, someone with protective factors could be, for example, healthy relationships, a solid community that supports them. And in contrast, risk factors are things that adversely impact a person's mental health. And these are associated with higher likelihood of negative outcomes. And mental health protective and risk factors are both influenced by all areas of life. So things like social environment, cultural, situational factors. So these things, depending on each individual and their circumstances, these factors can either provide them mental health protective factors or risk factors, increasing their likelihood of experiencing good mental health or mental health distress, mental health problems, all the way to psychosocial disabilities.
Can you give me a very simple example of how these psychosocial determinants influence a person's mental health? Something like a real life scenario.
Yeah, so to give an example, maybe say from a personal experience, for me as a Muslim Black woman, I have been impacted by systemic barriers when it comes to things like racism, discrimination because of my gender, and also race and religion. And this is really at a structural level. So it can be, for example, everyday racist encounters that you experience in education, in the workspace, or it could be, for example, you know, in social settings, experiencing things online. And this can cause an individual to experience stress or mental health distress. And it could be everyday examples, or it could be more of a structural systemic barrier that is long term. And this in combination can lead to mental health problems or increase your likelihood of experiencing more mental health risk factors and less mental health protective factors. And so when it comes to mental health, we really have to look at intersectionality. And this is really important because it does connect to our socioeconomic factors, social determinants. And intersectionality is the way of understanding social relations by examining intersecting forms of systemic discrimination. And this means acknowledging that social systems are complicated, and so are our identities. So when we look at things like gender, age, disability, sexuality, among others, when they intersect and interact to shape who we are and the challenges that we face, and many of these may be present at the same time. So it's kind of understanding that our identities are complicated, and therefore the experiences that we have. And this needs to be reflected when we look at mental health and the necessary support that individuals need.
When we talk about psychosocial model, we often also talk about the stigmatization of mental health. What is the role, in your opinion, that the language has in promoting an individual-centered approach to mental health, and therefore the influence that it has on like the stigmatization of mental health issues?
So language is very, very important. We know that when it comes to mental health, still today it's very prevalent that there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconceptions when it comes to mental health, and that can influence an individual's ability to receive support and also support others as well. And language shapes narratives, and that's why it's so important that we also address this. And because language has such a massive influence on our society on an individual level, this needs to be in line with a human rights-based approach as well. Words have a major impact on the way we think and act, and we use similar words to or constructs to categorize and make sense of the world that we live in. So depending on the society that we live in and our personal experiences, we associate words with specific concepts, societal movements, and opinions. And over the last decades and centuries, we've seen language used about mental health really change dramatically. So when using words, it's good to understand their history and what they represent in a specific society or community. And of course, it also depends on the languages that we speak. So when we talk about mental health as Mental Health Europe, we really try to promote language that does not fuel stigmatization and mental health continuing to be a taboo, but to really look at mental health as a human experience, as something that impacts us all, and something that should be better understood by society. within our understanding. So it has to be, for example, gender sensitive, culturally sensitive, and also accessible even in terms of the language and the words that we use. So it could be understood by everyone. Alongside this, we need to have better mental health literacy. So that means more understanding and education around what mental health is, in line with a psychosocial approach to mental health and how our mental health is impacted, as well as where we can receive support and how we can also support others.
Can you give me a few examples of words that are stigmatizing versus alternatives that we could use to promote a destigmatization of mental health?
We have a glossary actually as Mental Health Europe, and we say that, you know, it's not for us really to dictate what people should, what language they should be using, because it's to an individual level what people feel comfortable with and what most resonates with them. But we steer away from words such as mental health disease, disorder, really terminology that's more connected with the biomedical approach to mental health, and, you know, connecting mental health with something that is connected to genetics or something that needs to be cured, steer towards a human rights based approach, recovery based approach language, such as mental health problems, mental health issues. And that's the stance that we take as an organization, because we do feel that language also has a major role in pushing the psychosocial approach to mental health in line with the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities.
We talked about psychosocial determinants of mental health, we talked about destigmatization, but when we go into practice, how can mental health professionals integrate the psychosocial model into their practices?
The good news is that many already do, and there are many examples from all over the world, not only of innovative practice on an individual level, but whole systems which take a rights-based approach, avoiding automatically turning to drugs or compulsion as the first response to mental health. And indeed, Mental Health Europe has given information, is able to give information about many of these practices. And I think the professional who really wants to start to do things differently has to look around them to see what there is and talk to others who've gone down that route before. The best schemes that have been most influential and effective have started relatively small, with small local initiatives, and moved into not only influencing the medical practitioners or the practitioners around where they live, but also the systems of government and the systems of access to treatments.
One example that I can give is a Swedish personal ombudsman program. And this is a program which started in 1995 for people with psychosocial disabilities. And the ombudsman is a professional, highly skilled individual, usually, for example, a lawyer or social worker, and they don't have any alliances with psychiatric or social services. And their role is really to take great care and time to build trust and ensure that users receive the help and services which they're entitled to. And it's a really great example in terms of providing support and enabling a person to make and communicate decisions with respect to their personal and legal matters as well.
And now we are heading into a more of a policy framework, because we also need to apply the psychosocial model to legislations and to policies. And how can this happen? How can the psychosocial model inform mental health frameworks and legislations?
For example, applying the co-creation approach to mental health, which involves all relevant stakeholders, especially persons with lived experience, experts by experience. This ensures that, for example, decision makers include the very communities that are most impacted to help shape legislation and policies or initiatives, so that they are most efficient, ensuring that mental health is mainstreamed across different policy areas to reflect the cross-cutting nature of mental health. But also, psychosocial approach will push for dedicated action around mental health. So in our case, we are pushing for a European strategy on mental health, which will have specific things such as benchmarks, indicators, really ensuring accountability in implementing measures. Because it's one thing to have documents that recognize mental health and through an intersectional approach, cross-cutting approach, but then it's completely another to see it actually applied on the ground. So applying a psychosocial approach to mental health really allows for that to take place.
We did talk about all the potential that this model has, but also we need to address the challenges of implementing the psychosocial approach at a policy level. What do you think are the main obstacles in this sense, and how do you think this can be addressed?
We are seeing mental health and the psychosocial approach being integrated into these documents, but often that's not translated into action. So we need to see more initiatives focusing on next steps and how we can follow through with these policy recommendations. So that's really, really important. Another thing is that we require implementation on the ground. And one of the challenges around this is the fact that across Europe, it's very difficult to find disaggregated data around mental health. And this prevents us from actually pinpointing where we find challenges, where there are common issues, and where we can focus more of our efforts on, and also to see what we're doing well. So we need more funding. We need more funding on mental health, for community-based services, which often don't have long, sustainable funding, and it's often project-based, so we need more funding there. Also, another challenge is that, the biomedical model is still the dominant model, and we still have a way to go before we see that the psychosocial approach to mental health is really understood and applied in practice. So that's another challenge. And also mental health literacy. So ensuring that the general public have a better understanding of what mental health is, how our mental health is impacted, but also for professionals, especially those that will be on the front line, ensuring that the curricula is reflective of this human rights-based approach. And lastly, just to say that mental health, there's still massive stigma, and it's still to be within many communities. So we need to do more to address stigma and ensure that this is done through a societal approach.
The main challenge is that the sheer power of pharmaceutical companies, because they have been able to construct a narrative which has actually become current right across the political spectrum. Against this, we are seeing increasingly the power of social media in being able to disseminate alternative ways of thinking and ways of looking at things. So although it is a challenge and it is always a risk, it's possible these days to do that rather more effectively, I think, than people have been able to in the past. So there is, I think, what one might call a movement. It involves not only professionals who see things differently, but also service users who are using their life experience to challenge the ways in which they have been treated themselves. And it's very much noticeable that their voices are becoming louder and stronger.
Thank you for listening to Empowering Minds. You can keep following Mental Health Europe's work on our website and on our social media accounts on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube. Have a great day.